We go now to America's preeminent expert on failure.
Under ordinary circumstances, failing entities should be allowed to fail. I have concluded these are not ordinary circumstances.
Who could argue with this president about failed entities? The auto industry is still arguing for a bailout, though. Furloughed workers wait, circumstances unchanged, when saving the patient means, well, you get the idea. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 19th, and indeed, the White House has brought up the B word.
Yep.
Bankruptcy, perhaps, for the automakers. Also, the Minnesota U.S. Senate race is down to two votes, but there's more to the story, and we're going to tell you about it. Also, an apology from The Economist, plus its predictions for 2009. Those stories are coming up, but first, these headlines.
Also, we have a special guest. Nice, neat, and orderly. That's how a bankruptcy of the auto industry would work, according to Treasury Chief Hank Paulson.
If the right outcome is reorganization or bankruptcy, then isn't it better to get there through an orderly process where every effort is made to avoid it? And if it can't be avoided, everyone's prepared for it.
But the big three automakers themselves, along with the workers' union, still vehemently oppose the idea. A decision from the White House on the industry's future could be announced as early as today. Right now, the administration is getting flack for how it's handling the financial bailout. Harvard professor Elizabeth Warren says we don't know how the Treasury is spending the $700
billion. We've reversed directions more than once here without any description of an overall strategy. It's not to say there's not one, but I don't think it should be such a well-hidden secret.
Well, that's really comforting. Warren chairs the panel overseeing the $700 billion financial bailout.
The Watergate whistleblower Mark Felt, a.k.a. Deep Throat, has died. He was 95 years old. Felt was second in command at the FBI during the Watergate political investigation. He kept his role secret until just 3 years ago. Overseas, Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas is meeting with President Bush today. They'll discuss the stalled peace talks with Israel. The president met with Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert last month. Peace doesn't seem likely at the moment. Rockets were fired over the border earlier today. That's the Israeli-Palestinian border. It marked the end of a six-month ceasefire between Israel and Hamas.
A couple new names for the Obama cabinet. California Congresswoman Hilda Solis, Labor Secretary, according to transition officials. Former Dallas Mayor Ron Kirk, next up to be U.S. Trade Representative, according to transition officials. Asian markets mixed today after Japan's central bank cut its key interest rate, joining the Fed close to zero. Oil prices rose a bit. They're at $42 a barrel, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average and S&P are both poised to open flat or down this morning. In tough economic times, what would you tax? What fee would you charge to balance the books?
My suggestions for bettering the economy is to tax the jaywalkers.
The jaywalkers?
Yeah.
Okay, well, there's an idea. We want to hear yours. Should you tax bigger taxes on the toll roads, or should you tax chocolate? How about that? I bet you that would raise a whole lot of money. We want to hear your suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytakeatthetakeaway.org. 40 states facing major deficits.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. Responsibilityproject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
I believe that good policy is not to dump him a major catastrophe in his first day of office.
It's getting harder and harder to imagine as President Bush transitions to the Obama administration with so many serious problems, particularly in the domestic front, on the table. Everything President Bush has referred to in the last few weeks, whether it's the economic meltdown or the auto industry bailout, is something that's being teed up or handed off to the new administration. On the table now is a so-called orderly bankruptcy for the big three as they wait for a bailout from either this administration or the next. The Obama administration is going to have to deal with all of it. And joining us to talk about the inheritance, so to speak, quite literally, is David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He's author of the upcoming book, The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. He joins us from Washington. David, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, good to be back with you, John.
So tell us about this orderly bankruptcy option that you've reported on that seems to be surfacing in Washington that is something of a I can't tell if it's a favor they're doing the big three or if it's a sense of punishment and signs of bad times to come vis-a-vis Washington.
John, you ever haggled for a car?
Yeah, unsuccessfully, always.
Well, that's what you're watching going on right here. Look, it may turn out in the end that GM and perhaps Chrysler have to go into bankruptcy court. But by talking about bankruptcy here, I suspect what the administration is doing is trying to avoid that option, because George Bush doesn't want to leave office in the last 30 days of an administration that has had some other challenges, let's say, to the news that the world's biggest car maker and once the icon of American manufacturing is sitting in Chapter 11. What they want to do, if they can, is essentially what that House legislation that died in the Senate last week would have done, which was set up a managed restructuring, a forced negotiation that is done outside of bankruptcy court, in which the unions, the creditors, and the car makers all give in something and presumably come up with some kind of way to make the car makers viable. But the only way to get them there, especially in the absence of the legislation, is to start talking publicly about, gee, it'd be terrible if this didn't work out and we had to go leave it to the hands of a bankruptcy judge.
Right. So it's a bit of a, you know, big stick approach here. But, you know, in the way that these negotiations have gone on and the kinds of sound bites that we've heard over the last couple of weeks, it seems to me that, OK, we're going to bail out the big three. But then they go into a room somewhere, they open some book, they see something, and all of a sudden everything stops for a while. It's almost like there's something they're not telling us. Is it really as complicated as all of that?
Well, it's made more complicated by the fact that Congress didn't act last week, because, remember, you had an administration that for months has been saying that this TARP legislation, the Troubled Assets legislation that authorized the bailouts of the banks, was not intended for industrial companies and would not be used for industrial companies. Then Congress couldn't come together on a way to go deal with the auto companies, and President Bush is facing the prospect of the bankruptcy that we're discussing and, of course, the unemployment that would add to the 533,000 lost jobs last month. And suddenly, what do you know, they're trying to figure out a way to make sure that TARP legislation actually could be used for an industrial company.
All right. But for the furloughed auto workers who are going to have a lot of time to focus on the details here, what should they take from all this?
Well, there are a couple things that are going to happen. And, you know, I wrote a piece earlier this week that likened this to the Mideast negotiations. And I liken it to the Mideast negotiations because it's one of those cases where for 30 years we have all known, or at least for 10 years, we've all known what the rough outlines of an agreement look like, but we can't figure out how to get all the negotiators there. So one element of this is it's likely that the unions, as they now themselves recognize, are going to have to agree to total compensation cuts that would bring their income down to about the levels of the workers who work at Japanese or German auto plants in the United States. Those are the non-unionized plants. The second thing that's going to happen is that the creditors to these car companies are going to have to take a huge haircut. Probably, you know, they would be lucky to get 30 cents on the dollar. If you look at how their bonds are being traded right now, people are guessing they would get more like 15 cents on the dollar. So 30 cents may look pretty good to them. And the auto companies themselves are going to have to both downsize, take compensation cuts for the top executives, mm-hmm. obviously, and close a lot of factories.
David, this is what I don't understand. Why can't the Treasury write the check and then impose the same kind of constraints that the bankruptcy courts would on the company, on the companies, on the labor unions, and so on? If you want the money, then you must comply with these list of things, some of which you just mentioned.
Well, some of them they could, and they could say, look, if you want the money, here's what you got to go do. But that means getting many different participants to agree, the creditors, the unions, and the companies. Whereas when you were dealing with the banks, they basically could call in the bank chief executives and say, either sign this document and walk out the door, dealing with, you know, one person, or they could say, you know, don't sign this document and see how long you'll last in the market.
Right, but they know what the alternatives are because Detroit, the folks from the auto industry are the ones arguing that if we go down, here are all the terrible ripple effects.
That's right, but you don't have just one player here.
Right.
What you've got is the multiple players, and the unions in particular are thinking, gee, if we can hold on for 30 days, and so far we've held on for 30 years in this process, we might get a better deal out of Obama.
All right, but, you know, complexity hasn't kept the United States away from the Middle East, per se, although the Bush administration doesn't have much of a legacy there. Is it really the case that it's too complex, or the government just doesn't want to get involved because they don't want to get hung with the failure?
Well, they don't want to get hung with losing the taxpayers' money.
I see.
And so let's say, for example, that the taxpayers were on the hook for $14 billion here, which was the number that was kicking around in the House bill last week. Obviously, the debt to the U.S. taxpayers comes first. But if they can't come up with some kind of long-term viability plan, they'll burn through that money in 5, 6, 7 months, and we'll be right back where we are today. So they want to make sure, or so President Bush said yesterday, that I think President Bush's phrase was that we're not throwing good money after bad.
Well, you know,
you don't want a bridge loan to nowhere.
Right. Well, on that precise point, you know, I want to talk to you a little bit about the title of your book, The Inheritance.
Mm-hmm.
It's looking a little bit more like a sinkhole. What Obama is going to get from the world right now as he takes power on January 20th. As a legacy for the Bush administration, I mean, it's not so much that Obama is inheriting things, is that he's being hung with stuff that are going to be very, very difficult challenges in the first quarter of 2009.
Hey, you know, not every inheritance is always pleasant, right?
Right.
People think inheritance and they think, gee, big pot of money at the end of the rainbow here. Not this time. The book tries to lay out, mostly in the foreign policy sphere, what were the true costs of the distraction of the Iraq War. The argument of the book is that beyond the awful clear costs of Iraq, you know, more than 4,000 Americans dead, untold numbers of Iraqis dead, $800 billion. It seems like everything Washington does these days is $700 or $800 billion, right? It's the bottom line number. But the real cost was the cost that the opportunity cost, that we found ourselves in a situation where Iran is on the verge of a nuclear weapon because you had a president who couldn't stand up after Iraq and talk publicly about countries getting weapons of mass destruction. North Korea's got 8 at the end of the Bush administration, up from 0 or 1 when he came in. As you go around the world, Afghanistan is in far worse shape, in part because we moved too many troops over to Iraq and thought the Taliban were gone. And Pakistan is fighting both sides of the war.
Right.
So what the book tries to do is pace you through how we got where we are and what Obama's options are.
Well, let's very quickly, because we're under a minute here, would you look for Obama creating some sort of new relationship in a part of the world that we haven't focused on typically as a way out of this? Or would you figure that he would recreate a broad coalition starting in Europe, as most presidents do?
I think he'll start in Europe because it's the easiest win. He's got a bigger challenge in Asia than he thinks because China, during the time that President Bush has been in power, has truly managed to expand its own power because we were distracted elsewhere.
Part of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. The author is David Sanger. He's chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Thanks, David.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Well, here's a clever little Christmas story that involves taxes. When, Herod needed some cash, it was pretty blunt. It was pretty simple. You basically, Mary and Joseph had to hop on the donkey. They had to go down to Bethlehem. They basically had to hand over cash. It was as simple as that.
Where do you come up with these things, John? In our 21st century,
in this economic environment, well, the Bible, you know, it's a book, a very big bestseller. You may have heard of it. In this economic environment, tax professionals have to be much more clever, much more creative, which is why we've asked Stephen Zelen here, who's Zelen, right?
Zelen.
Okay, Stephen Zelen, who is an accountant, right? And people think that accountancy is really, really boring, and that is, in fact, true, correct?
That is definitely true.
Yeah, right. But they're looking at the fine print, which you do all day, right?
All day.
As a CPA.
As a CPA here in New York. You get ideas, right?
You do.
About how to make money, how to charge people for things. I mean, you probably have an invoice that contains a lot of fees, right?
Oh, I was going to give it to you right after this interview.
Yes, exactly. So you're probably charging me for looking at you strangely.
That's right. I have a little button.
Yeah, there we go. See?
Easy pass.
Just adding
exactly.
up by the second.
There we go.
I got it, Stephen.
Was I right?
Yes, you were right.
Well, we have asked all of you to supply your expertise on what it is that governments should begin to tax to help balance budgets all over the country, because it's a very serious issue that state and city governments are having all kinds of shortfalls. 877-8 mytake@thetakeaway.org. But we wanted to begin with Stephen here, who's actually thought quite a lot, and you have your guitar, which actually scares me a little bit, because you're not simply going to talk about what accountants do in their spare moments. You're going to sing about what accountants think about regarding taxes, correct?
That's right. I'll be happy to sing.
But before we get to that, what's the difference between a tax and a fee?
There really is not a whole lot of difference between a tax and a fee. It's essentially it's the same thing.
Is one more fun? I mean, if you came up with a tax, is that kind of boring? But if you come up with a fee, people go, well, that was a good one.
Well, it's much easier to rhyme the word fee than to rhyme the word tax. Fee is much more fun.
You got wax.
And states have given you lots to sing about when you look at some of the proposals you have, like in California.
Facts.
This week became the 27th state to tax alcohol, and Idaho, Oregon, and South Dakota, they're talking about new gasoline taxes. So
they're raising the taxes on everything. It's crazy.
Adora is into facts.
Okay, it's fascinating about how these states are trying to deal with these billion-dollar shortfalls that they have. And you've been watching this closely, Stephen.
That's right. I think that what the states need to do is really look carefully at their budgets, and I think they need to slash them. They need to go through them with a fine-tooth comb a little bit more before they start coming up with these ridiculous taxes.
As an accountant, do you have a fine-tooth comb, or is it a big highlighter that's like blot? You know, it's like a Sharpie. Gone.
my hair is growing inside now, but definitely I have a microscope, especially for budgets like the state budgets.
Do you do accountancy for governmental entities, or is it mostly private clients?
Mostly private, nonprofit organizations.
I see. Well, we're a nonprofit organization. So you wrote a song, correct?
That's right.
And explain how this song begins to tackle the problem of what state and local governments are to do in this predicament.
Well, Governor Patterson announced
the governor of New York.
That's right. He announced his budget during the holiday season. And so,
it has a number of ideas of what to tax.
That's right.
And you decided to, as a shorthand, musical shorthand, put some of those ideas into this song.
That's right.
All right, great. Stephen Zelen, the singing CPA with, do you have a title of the song?
Giving All My Money to the Man.
All right. Like it. Go.
All my pay, they are taxing. Got no time for relaxing. They're robbing me here, they're robbing me there, giving all my money to the man. Tax my tax, preparation fee, my legal bill, when I have to plead.
He's not bad.
My Pepsi and Coke, along with my stroke, giving all my money to the man. Now the governor wants to take more money. He vowed no income tax hikes as a rule, but taxing everything else isn't funny. We still must pay for health care and for school. Tax the wine and the beer. All my savings disappear. My music downloads, it's coming to the codes. Giving all my money to the man.
Steven,
they're
Steven,
taxing
Steven,
my
Steven,
gas.
Steven, that's incredible.
They're taxing my ass. Giving all my money to the man.
That
is fabulous. Wow. He can do that. He can do
but
it.
But you're right, now, though. In New York, they're talking about taxing downloads on iTunes and soft drinks.
Steven, I'm speechless. First of all, I just have a question. You know, I may be like out of bounds on this. Do you celebrate Christmas?
No,
right.
I don't.
So you're Jewish, right?
Yes.
So you're a Jewish accountant who came in here to sing a Christmas carol on live radio?
That's right.
You are one brave dude. That's all I have to say.
Nice song, though.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. When did you come up with this? Did we ask you to do this, or did you
yes,
do this?
Yes, I was up all night writing this song.
Oh, and we have to say thank you very much, Stephen. We will talk to you again soon. I'm sure the crisis isn't going away anytime soon. That's
certainly
sure.
not.
Stephen Zelin is the singing, actually one of many singing CPAs, but I like to think he's the best. He's the best in my book. Thank you, Stephen. And here we have headlines from Femi Okeh.
Hello, good morning. The time is 27 minutes past the hour. President Bush is expected to make a statement at the top of this hour about the auto bailout. The administration has said the economy can't handle a collapse of Detroit's Big Three. Now, one of the options being floated is for automakers to file for orderly bankruptcy. In Minnesota, Republican Senator Norm Coleman is leading Democrat Al Franken by just 2 votes in the recount for the Senate race. The Minnesota Supreme Court has ruled that improperly rejected absentee ballots must be included in the state's recount, a move that nearly guarantees the recount drag on through into next year. Polaroid has announced that it's filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The 17-year-old Minnesota-based company says that it needs to restructure its finances. The move comes just 2.5 months after the founder of its parent company, Tom Pettus, was arrested on fraud charges. Zimbabwe's opposition leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, says that his party will withdraw from power-sharing talks with President Robert Mugabe's party, and that's unless the abductions of opposition supporters are stopped. Tsvangirai says that if the detained members of his MDC party were not released by the 1st of January, he would ask for the suspension of all contact and negotiations. And just this week, the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says that they really do need to get their act together in Zimbabwe and work out their differences regarding cabinet positions. It's been dragging on since September. And also this little note, or not so little note, 10 billion note for Zimbabwe currency is about to be printed.
They're printing the 10 billion note.
Yes.
Whose face is on it?
I want to get one. We should get one.
Well, what is that worth? About $1, $10?
20 cents.
20 cents.
Yeah. So if we go to Zimbabwe, we can all be billionaires.
That's tragic on so many levels.
That's a look at some of the stories making news for you this morning.
Thanks, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. States are proposing new fees and taxes. Many states, dozens, perhaps as many as all 40 of the states that are facing major shortfalls in their budgets. What would you tax or put a fee on to balance the books?
My name is Merv Horn. The fairest way to pay for debt is progressive income tax. It's not fees, not taxes on particular products, and not fines for parking, but progressive income tax.
Progressive income tax, does that do it for you? What are your thoughts on how the states can raise some money? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We're going to head overseas now to Jerusalem. A six-month ceasefire between Israel and Palestinian militants in Gaza has expired. Late on Thursday, Hamas announced it would not be extending that truce. In recent weeks, there's already been an upsurge in violence. For the latest, we go now to Jerusalem and BBC correspondent Katia Adler. Welcome, Katia.
Hello.
So do you want to describe the dynamics that have triggered Hamas saying that they would not extend the truce?
Well, it comes as little surprise. There had been some speculation perhaps the six-month truce would be extended, but frankly, it's been a very weak truce at best, both sides pointing to the other and saying that they weren't keeping their side of the bargain. Hamas says, look, Israel has kept up its economic blockade of the Gaza Strip throughout, leading to crippling shortages, so much so that the United Nations said yesterday, on Thursday, that they had halted all food handouts to 750,000 people in the Strip. Whereas Israel says to Hamas, well, why should we lift the blockade? You didn't keep your side of the bargain. You didn't stop smuggling weapons into the Gaza Strip. You didn't help us towards the eventual release of our captured soldier, Gilad Shalit, believed to be in Gaza. You didn't prevent all rocket fire by Palestinian militants in Gaza at Israeli towns. And therefore, what was our incentive to lift the blockade? So it's a very familiar, an all too familiar, gloomy picture with a lot of finger pointing and people on the ground worried that the end of this imperfect ceasefire now could lead to an escalation in hostilities.
There are many reports that suggest that the truce, which you call fragile to begin with, really began, though, unraveling last week when there was a series of violent clashes. Can you tell us about some of those?
Well, to be honest, you know, everybody always likes to say, well, it was then. It really depends who you ask, because, again, when you go into Gaza and you ask Gazans, they'll say that this ceasefire, weak or not weak, has made very little difference to their lives anyway, that they have been suffering under Israeli punishment ever since Hamas won the Palestinian parliamentary elections in January 2 years ago, that in fact that has intensified ever since Hamas seized internal control over the Gaza Strip 18 months ago. So again, to get into the details of whether it was a week ago or 5 weeks ago or whatever, the basic scenario is this. Hamas says it will now do anything to protect the Palestinian people. Israel says it's ready for a ground invasion of Gaza if necessary. That is now that the ceasefire has ended, leading to many people saying, well, an imperfect ceasefire surely was better than none, at whichever point things seem to get worse. However, if you want to look for a glimmer of hope in this miserable situation, it is this, that neither Hamas nor Israel seem keen to be the first ones to escalate hostilities. And also, they're very distracted by other matters. Hamas,
right,
by an internal political struggle, and Israel by the upcoming general election.
Exactly. So they've both got their own political situations to deal with. And do you think that will be enough to prevent an escalation?
Well, again, I think, you know, once you start working in the Middle East, you realize that it's a very bad idea to make any predictions, because you never know what's going to happen, because all you need is for that one rocket fired by one Palestinian militant that happens to land in a schoolyard or somewhere where there are many casualties, or all you need is one Israeli airstrike to hit a lot of civilians in one go and the whole thing can just explode. So that's very difficult to say. However, it's not really in the interests of Israel at the moment or the Palestinian political leadership in the Gaza Strip to really ratchet up the violence, because they need to concentrate their attentions elsewhere.
And is there any sense that there is any anticipation there for the Obama administration, which is going to take over in just over 1 month?
Well, I mean, yes, there's skepticism. There's a lot of thought, to be honest. I mean, Israel was not very keen on Obama. Many Israelis looked to his middle name, Hussein, and said, surely this is not going to be a friend of Israel. However, he did give a very strong speech to the Israeli community, the Jewish community, saying very clearly that there should be peace, yes, with the Palestinians, but that Israeli security must always be respected and that Jerusalem must always remain the capital of Israel. Now, this is music to the ears of most Israelis, and it's very depressing to hear for most Palestinians. They want an eventual Palestinian state to have East Jerusalem as their capital. There is an awareness also, though, that there is a big economic crisis in the United States, and nobody expects Barack Obama to concentrate first on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So I think for the moment, people feel that in the area, they're sort of on their own. They're concentrating on their own domestic agendas, and then at the wider one as well. I mean, Israel is very concerned about the perceived threat from Iran. It's very aware that a deal with the Palestinians is no good if there is no wider recognition from the Arab world. And the Palestinians are also looking around, looking at the greater security in the region. These are times very much, as you know, Adora, where people don't just look at their own doorstep, but where their house is situated on the larger street, if you like.
Well, that was a nice way of putting it. Katya Adler, thanks so much for that update. Katya Adler is a BBC Middle East correspondent, and she was reporting to us from Jerusalem on the Israeli-Palestinian truce that Hamas says it will no longer honor. Now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got headlines for us.
And the time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour. And at the very top of the hour, we will be covering live a statement from President Bush. He's expected to be talking about the auto bailout. President-elect Barack Obama is nearly finished choosing his cabinet. At his fifth news conference of the week today, he's expected to name California Congresswoman Hilda Solis for Labor Secretary and former Dallas Mayor Ron Kirk for the U.S. Trade Representative, and retiring GOP Congressman Ray LaHood as his Transportation Secretary. Now, according to Pentagon sources, Defense Secretary Robert Gates has ordered his aides to draw up plans on how to close Guantanamo. Barack Obama has identified closing the detention center as a priority for his administration. Now, the governor of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich, is supposed to be holding a press conference today. Blagojevich is facing federal charges of trying to sell the Senate seat vacated by Barack Obama. When he was out for a jog on Wednesday, he told a throng of reporters that he couldn't wait to tell his story. But now his lawyer said that he may not be speaking at all. And lawyer Ed Jensen is giving signs of his defense strategy. Yes, he says that he will challenge the lawfulness of the court-ordered wiretaps at the heart of the investigation. So we look forward to that press conference later today. Let's look at your news for now.
Thanks, Barry.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Adora Udoji. And I want you right now to listen very, very carefully to the group of people, or one group of people in Minnesota, who are still counting the votes in the U.S. Senate race.
If there's a lizard people, there's a flying spaghetti monster.
Flying spaghetti monster?
No. It's middle name, spaghetti. Oh.
Are they talking about ballots?
I gotta see this one too. It looks like a couple of names on there.
Well, at least they didn't put their address label on it.
Let me see. What do I need to do? I move to reject the challenge and to designate the ballot for Franken.
Wow.
That's the process, and it's happened over and over again in the nearly 3 million votes that were cast in the Senate race. Right now, incumbent Senator Norm Coleman is leading by two votes, just two votes. Late yesterday, the Minnesota Supreme Court ruled that improperly rejected absentee ballots should be included in the state's recount. We're joined now by Tom Scheck, who is a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio, and as always, we're grateful to have you, Tom, but what in the world is going on?
Well, first off, we're now referring to this as the 2009 Senate race, no longer the 2008 Senate race, because with what the court did yesterday, we're not going to know a winner until early 2009. The court said, you know what, you need to allow any rejected absentee ballots that were wrongly rejected for without legal basis, so to speak, to be accepted. But we're going to set some stipulations. The Secretary of State, the campaigns, who never agree on anything, and the local elections officials all have to come up with an agreement on how you can define what is a wrongly rejected absentee ballot They have to do that. Then they have to, you know, get together, count these extra 1,600 votes or how many there are, and then they have to give these votes and count them to the state canvassing board by New Year's Eve.
And, Tom, every single vote counts. So really what you're describing is a uniform standard for counting each of the votes. Did they suggest any way that all of these people that you just talked about can make that determination?
Well, there have been some arguments that it shouldn't be this difficult, but it will be, because obviously the campaigns have a very vested interest in this. But there are four legal reasons why you can define a rejected absentee ballot. They don't have a signature on the envelope. They don't have a witness. They don't have a voter registration card, or they didn't fill out the form properly, I think was number four. So those are the reasons when you go through and look. If they don't fall within those four categories, then they should be counted. That's what the Supreme Court is saying. But there could be gray areas there where, you know, the campaigns could argue about this.
Okay, quickly, lizard people and flying spaghetti monsters, are those special categories?
No, those aren't. That's actually what the state canvassing board is doing. When they're finding these as write-in votes. They also had write-in votes for God, Chuck Norris, Mickey Mouse. There was one guy who wrote in all of the Beatles. So he wrote in John Lennon, Paul McCartney, Ringo Starr. But listen to this. Then he said the other one. So George got a little bit of not a lot of love there, so to speak. I mean, there are all these crazy things that people do with their ballots that no one ever even thinks or sees except for election workers. Now, you know, the whole state of Minnesota and outside of that, they're seeing this because they're putting all of these ballots on a widescreen as they go through them.
Well, Tom, yep. I got a couple words for you. You guys are really special up there in Minnesota. We thank you for joining us.
You got it.
Tom Scheck is a reporter with Minnesota Public Radio, and he's keeping us up to date on the U.S. Senate race there.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 19th, and Femi Oke has joined us with the headlines.
And the time is 13 minutes to the top of the hour, just a few minutes away from when President Bush will be speaking live about the auto bailout, and we will carry that statement. The Palestinian group Hamas says that its six-month ceasefire with Israel has expired. The truce ends today, and Hamas says that they will not renew it. Israelis reported that rocket fire across the border happened today. President Bush will discuss the peace process with the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas. California Congresswoman Hilda Solis is next in line to be Labor Secretary. That's according to transition officials, and she'll be the third Hispanic member of the Obama cabinet. The announcement's expected later today. Also joining Team Obama is the former Dallas mayor, Ron Kirk. He's next up to be the U.S. Trade Representative, and he's a proponent of NAFTA and China's entry into the World Trade Organization. Deep Throat, the man whose anonymous tips to the Washington Post helped topple President Nixon, has died. Mark Felt passed information to the Washington Post about a break-in at the Democratic Party headquarters in 1974. And let's look at some of the big stories making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
You've changed. That sparkle in your eyes is gone.
It's a changing situation on a couple of fronts. The federal government, it's expected to announce when President Bush takes the microphone in 10 minutes, will provide $17.4 billion in short-term financing to U.S. automakers. A bailout is at hand. But it's also a changing situation for governors. 40 states are facing shortfalls in their budgets for this year. We decided to ask two to join the program. We turn to New Jersey's governor, John Corzine, who's coming to us from Princeton. Governor, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
And also Jim Doyle, who's the governor of Wisconsin. He's on the line from Madison. Governor Doyle, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Now, you testified before Congress last week, and you're looking for federal assistance. There's already been a lot of talk about helping the states with infrastructure projects, but I suspect you need something more quick and in the form of cash. Governor Doyle, why don't you begin?
Well,
one of my great fears about where we are as far in the economic situation of the country is that we end up doing things, cutting things that move us 20, 25 years behind. And so particularly in the area of education, kindergarten through 12, four-year-old kindergarten in Wisconsin, higher education, we have a university system that we're very, very proud of. We put a lot of money into and work hard to keep it affordable for people. And in the kind of deficits we're facing, it is going to be a great struggle to hold that educational system even. There are others as well, health care and so on. But I really believe that our highest responsibility here is to make sure that we don't move backwards during this time and find ourselves coming out of the recession 2 years from now, hopefully sooner than that, but actually further behind the rest of the world in education. So it's a great challenge for us right now because in Wisconsin, I know, in New Jersey as well, and states all across the country, we just are facing these huge declines in revenue that is now coming into the states.
I want to remind people that's Governor Jim Doyle, the governor of Wisconsin. Governor Corzine of New Jersey, I want to hear your individual challenges, but do you envision, broadly speaking, a different relationship between the federal government and the states as we go forward in terms of how revenue is shared and how budgets are helped out by federal resources?
I think all of us are quite encouraged by a partnership building exercise that we feel is building with the new administration. First time in history that many of us that gone back and looked that the president-elect sat down with all governors, Democrat, Republican. 48 of us showed up at a meeting in Philadelphia to talk about just the things that Jim just mentioned. I think all of us are concerned about setting ourselves back in the kinds of investments we're making towards America's future. And second, I think that equally important, we will end up offsetting any kinds of actions that the federal government takes if we're not a partner in that stimulus and recovery program that the new administration is looking to put together. I know Jim and I have talked about this. We're talking about either layoffs or we've already reduced the size of our workforce about 4,000 people over the last 2 years. We're in the midst of seeing 14-15% two-year declines in revenue. And the only way that can be done is by cutting things like education, which makes no sense in the long run, cutting our social safety net just at the time we're supposed to be using that to help the unemployed, those that are really stressed in this kind of economic climate. And this president-elect has really reached out to the governors and I think intends to be a partner with us in doing the best thing for the country.
I think it's abundantly clear, and Americans fundamentally understand that this is a very difficult economic time. But I'm wondering, governors, at some point something's got to give, and how are you going to convince your citizens that they are going to have to give up something? Governor Corzine?
Well, I think the citizens already know that they're going to have to see their governments cut back. We're not asking for the federal government to fill all the holes that we would have if we were operating at a normalized economic growth rate. The kinds of help that we're asking for is only a partial fix to the fall off in revenues. I talked about 14-15% over 2 years. There's no way we're expecting the federal government to fill that up. So we're going to have to make some tough choices as it is. I think the public needs to understand that when the sun's shining, when the economy is actually doing well, we have to make disciplined decisions so that we don't overspend. But on the other hand, we need to educate our kids. We need solid preschool and kindergarten and quality curriculum in our high schools if we're going to compete with in the 21st century. And just as Jim was talking about, we need to make sure we sustain that in this period of economic recession. We need to make sure that we're investing in that infrastructure. Just like people did during the Depression, they built the George Washington Bridge, the Golden Gate Bridge, and a lot of what is important to make our country work today.
The George Washington Bridge that no one in Manhattan calls a bridge to nowhere anymore, Governor Corzine from New Jersey.
I
don't think so. So Governor Doyle from Wisconsin, some have talked on this program and elsewhere that an immediate stimulus package that would be would have instant impact on the economy would be to give direct money into the general funds of states so they could rehire their laid off state workers. Is that an approach that you favor, or do you think that the Obama administration is looking exclusively on the private sector side?
Oh, I think they understand our situation, and they've been, as John said, they've worked very closely with us. So I would expect that there will be help that will come to the states, not just money handed to us, but really directed at making sure that we can run our basic health care programs in the state that help people, particularly at this very difficult time. And I hope that make sure that we can sustain our educational systems. But as John mentioned, I don't think the administration intends, nor should they intend, to just say, here's a bunch of money, states, go hire who you want to. We're in a very, and I'm not alone. John's done the same thing. 10% of our workforce is current, of our state positions are currently vacant. We have cut just in this year $500 million of our state budget. And we're going to have to do more of that. We understand this is a very, very difficult time, and that it's going to require deep cuts on the states, in the states' budgets. But that being said, I hope in Wisconsin agrees that we cannot go to a point where kids go start when they go to school, they don't find a class of 17 or 18 kids, but they find a class of 35 kids waiting for them, or when a university student tries to sign up for the next semester, they find that their tuition's just gone up 25% and they can't afford it. Those things are avoidable. I believe this country, the states, the federal government working together, we're willing to make sacrifices and have at the state side to cut other sorts of things to preserve our basic priorities in education and basic health care. And I believe that the federal government, under the leadership of President Obama, is also going to help us make sure that we don't have to make deep cuts. Everybody's going to have to, the schools are going to have less, the university's going to have less, but not the kind of cuts that just devastate education in this country.
Well, they're both on the front lines of the fiscal crisis in America, Governors Jim Doyle from Wisconsin and John Corzine from New Jersey. Thanks to both of you.
They sound a little pained, actually,
yeah,
John.
More than a little.
Yeah, they have a lot of very complicated things to weave through. Anyhow, if you missed anything on our show, take our podcast to go. Subscribe now at thetakeaway.org or iTunes. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. Details on a new bailout for the auto industry at the top of the hour. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry with Adora Udoji, and we have a bailout, apparently, and are waiting for President Bush to speak live on an auto bailout that apparently includes two very important details, $13.4 billion in short-term financing directly from the TARP, that's the so-called financial bailout that's in the federal treasury, and $4 billion to be added later. The details of this will be announced by the president, who is expected to speak within the next minute or so. We will be talking in reaction to the president's remarks with a couple of guests as well.
We certainly will. Micheline Maynard, who's a senior business correspondent for the New York Times. Good morning, Mickey.
Good morning.
And Todd Zwillick will be joining us at some point. He's from Capital News Connection.
Yeah, when we hear the details of what the president is going to say, we'll be going to them and talking with them as well. One thing I do want to say is the negotiations have taken place over the last several days. There was talk this morning of a so-called structured bankruptcy, and one of the things we're likely to hear from the president when he does speak live is details on what conditions the automakers are made to actually meet to get this money. Certainly, stronger conditions for GM and Chrysler, which are in the worst financial
financial shape. Ford, maybe less so, but those details to come from the president. We're going to get some headlines now from Femi Okeh, but we are awaiting President Bush to speak live on the auto bailout from the White House. Femi?
Good morning, all. I'm just looking at the Associated Press Newswire. They have been speaking to a senior administration official. He's speaking anonymously, so a few details about the deal. But I do believe the president is heading to the podium. John Adora?
Shrinking share of the market and declining profits. In recent months, the global financial crisis has made these challenges even more severe. Now some U.S. auto executives say that their companies are nearing collapse and that the only way they can buy time to restructure is with help from the federal government. It's a difficult situation that involves fundamental questions about the proper role of government. On the one hand, government has a responsibility not to undermine the private enterprise system. On the other hand, government has a responsibility to safeguard the broader health and stability of our economy. Addressing the challenges in the auto industry requires us to balance these two responsibilities. If we were to allow the free market to take its course now, it would almost certainly lead to disorderly bankruptcy and liquidation for the automakers. Under ordinary economic circumstances, I would say this is the price that failed companies must pay. And I would not favor intervening to prevent the automakers from going out of business. But these are not ordinary circumstances. In the midst of a financial crisis and a recession, allowing the U.S. auto industry to collapse is not a responsible course of action. The question is how we can best give it a chance to succeed. Some argue the wisest path is to allow the auto companies to reorganize through Chapter 11 provisions of our bankruptcy laws and provide federal loans to keep them operating while they try to restructure under the supervision of a bankruptcy court. But given the current state of the auto industry and the economy, Chapter 11 is unlikely to work for American automakers at this time. American consumers understand why. If you hear that a car company is suddenly going into bankruptcy, you worry that parts and servicing will not be available.
This is The Takeaway. We are listening to President Bush speaking live from the White House on an announced bailout for the auto industry.
With consumers hesitant to buy new cars from struggling automakers, it would be more. American people want the auto companies.
This is The Takeaway. We're listening to President Bush speaking live from the White House on an announced auto industry bailout.
The federal government will grant loans to auto companies under conditions similar to those Congress considered last week. These loans will provide help in two ways. First, they will give automakers 3 months to put in place plans to restructure into viable companies, which we believe they are capable of doing. Second, if restructuring cannot be accomplished outside of bankruptcy, the loans will provide time for companies to make the legal and financial preparations necessary for an orderly Chapter 11 process that offers a better prospect of long-term success and gives consumers confidence that they can continue to buy American cars. Because Congress failed to make funds available for these loans, the plan I'm announcing today will be drawn from the financial rescue package Congress approved earlier this fall. The terms of the loans will require auto companies to demonstrate how they would become viable. They must pay back all their loans to the government and show that their firms can earn a profit and achieve a positive net worth. This restructuring will require meaningful concessions from all involved in the auto industry, management, labor unions, creditors, bondholders, dealers, and suppliers. In particular, automakers must meet conditions that experts agree are necessary for long-term viability, including putting their retirement plans on a sustainable footing, persuading bondholders to convert their debt into capital the companies need to address immediate financial shortfalls, and making their compensation competitive with foreign automakers who have major operations in the United States. If a company fails to come up with a viable plan by March 31st, it will be required to repay its federal loans. The automakers and unions must understand what is at stake and make hard decisions necessary to reform. These conditions send a clear message to everyone involved in the future of American automakers. The time to make hard decisions to become viable is now, or the only option will be bankruptcy. The actions I'm announcing today represent a step that we wish were not necessary. But given the situation, it is the most effective and responsible way to address this challenge facing our nation. By giving the auto companies a chance to restructure, we will shield the American people from a harsh economic blow at a vulnerable time. And we will give American workers an opportunity to show the world once again they can meet challenges with ingenuity and determination and bounce back from tough times and emerge stronger than before. Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway. That was President Bush announcing from the White House that there is an automaker bailout plan.
And we have a
that
lot
includes $17.4 right. billion dollars that will go to the industry, and they have until March 31st to reorganize.
Well, let's recap a little bit before we go to our guests to talk about the reaction from an agreement on a federal bailout for the auto industry. This will affect the big three in which ways we do not know. Will Ford, Chrysler, and GM get the same amounts? All those details remaining to be known. But what we do know now is there are 3 months to establish viability. There's going to be time additionally given to allow for an orderly Chapter 11 process if a company does fall into bankruptcy. There's a March 31st deadline to demonstrate viability, including the ability to pay back loans from the federal government. Meaningful concessions will need to be demonstrated by that time, including union and management. And viability will also mean, according to the president, a demonstration of sources of capital, sustainability of pension plans, et cetera. But the big headline is the $17.4 billion in short-term financing will come in large part from the Federal Treasury's TARP program, $13.4 billion in short-term financing that will need to be paid back coming from the TARP, and then $4 billion to be added later. That's from President Bush, who just spoke from the White House on an agreement on a Big Three auto plan.
He said that there was no choice, that going into bankruptcy was not an option for the auto industry at this time in our economy, and that is why the White House felt it needed to act. Joining us now to take a look and think and have some thoughts on what the president has just announced is Micheline Maynard, senior business correspondent for The New York Times. Welcome, Mickey.
Good morning.
Todd Zwillick is also with us from Washington, D.C. He's with Capital News Connection. Good morning, Todd.
Hi, good morning.
Micheline, your reaction?
Well, I think you have to look at the picture beyond March 31st. What the president has basically said is that the government is giving the car makers this money and this time in order for them to prepare restructuring plans. And he said Chapter 11 several times during his statement, and that is no accident. Essentially, they've got a little bit over 3 months to get their act together or they end up in bankruptcy.
I mean, it seems even though the president was talking about we can't allow the auto industry to fail bankruptcy, Chapter 11 is clearly on the table here with the statements before this and now these details that have come out. Right, Micheline?
That's absolutely right. And I think that it kind of has been coming out in stages. And in fact, I'd had discussions with legal sources going back as far as November saying this is exactly what the Bush administration would end up doing if there was no congressional bailout, that the feeling was that it takes just too long to do a bankruptcy case for one of these big companies, that they needed months to prepare. Well, now they've got 3 months to prepare, and they've got some financing to get them through while they prepare, but there's not a single analyst in the auto industry who thinks that the market will pick up over the next 3 months. In fact, the first quarter of the year mm-hmm. is always the toughest for the car makers.
And Todd, clearly a 360-degree turn from yesterday when for the first time we were hearing from the spokeswoman at the White House that bankruptcy might be the best option for automakers. What happened in the last 24 hours?
Well, I think without being in the room with them, Adora, as of course none of us was, we don't really know what happened except that you can take a little bit of an educated guess on what that was all about. There, you know, there's the classic trial balloon, which is floating the idea of what Perino and the president both called a soft landing, some kind of soft bank, or orderly bankruptcy. for the car makers, just to give people a little bit of a warning, let them know it was a possibility. And I would also agree with what Micheline just said, which is a lot of lawyers that she talks to think this is inevitable anyway. So you might have seen the White House sending a very clear signal that this is in fact about bankruptcy, and you guys better clearly are going to be using this time to get your act together for some kind of Chapter 11 proceeding.
Well,
Todd, there are signals here,
but there's also details. I mean, is this a done deal? Does Congress have to weigh in on this? I mean, what sort of details have to be worked out? This $4 billion that's going to be added later, does that involve Congress in any way, as far as you can see at this point?
Okay, the $4 billion later will involve Congress. The 13.4, I think, is the right number up front, probably doesn't have to, because there's about $15 billion left in that TARP fund now. And the White House, of course, has almost complete discretion over how to use it. So the second installment of that, anything that would go beyond around about 15, would need Congress to reauthorize essentially the second half of that $700 billion TARP fund. And that is something that's going to get fairly complicated between the administration and Congress, but it looks as though that can come later. They can do the first hit of this $13.4 billion without having to deal with broader,
right,
stickier issues with Congress, which is about the financial industry.
That could wait to the inauguration. Micheline, quickly, if Ford agrees not to take any of this money, are they out of this March 31st window business, as far as you can tell right now?
They are, and I think if they don't take any of the money, they don't have to do any of this other stuff, like allowing the government to have power to block large transactions, get concessions from the UAW. And by not tapping the money, Ford gets an awful lot of flexibility, and even 3 months of that flexibility will be a competitive advantage for Ford.
What about General Motors? They're in the worst shape, it seems, at this point. Are they going to be able to make their supplier payment in the early part of January as a result of this, Micheline?
Well, I think this gives them some time. This gives them some liquidity. So, yeah, they'll make some of those supplier payments, and so will Chrysler. But essentially, this is a controlled descent into Chapter 11 for both General Motors and Chrysler, unless they can find funding from another source, if they could sell assets, if Cerberus, the owner of Chrysler, were to step up and put some fresh money into Chrysler instead of letting it file for bankruptcy.
All right, well, there's a lot to talk about here. Again, just to recap, the president has just spoken to the details of a $17.4 billion rescue package for the big three automakers. It's not clear, as we've been discussing, who's going to take that money, but it seems very clear that General Motors and Chrysler, at the very least, will be. $13.4 billion comes from the TARP, and $4 billion will be added later. There are many details to be worked out, and we're talking about those details with Todd Zwillick of Capital News Connection, who we're going to ask to stay with us, and also Micheline Maynard, who's economics writer for the New York Times. She's going to stay with us. More reaction also in towns across the country where this news is very much awaited in this holiday season. Stay with us.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Given the current state of the auto industry and the economy, Chapter 11 is unlikely to work for American automakers at this time.
Unlikely to work, but it is on the table. That is President George Bush speaking just a few moments ago from the White House, announcing an actual bailout plan for the big three automakers, $13.4 billion to come from the TARP, the Federal Treasury, and $4 billion or so to come later in details that will be worked out by Congress. This is the second time this morning we've spoken with the mayor of Kokomo, Indiana, Greg Goodnight. He joins us now via his cell phone because he's on his way to a joint press conference later
frustrated today with the governor of Indiana, Mitch Daniels, in reaction to all of this. Mayor, good night. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Now, at least 14% of your labor force is involved in the Chrysler Corporation and the plant that you have in your district. Also, there's a supplier plant in Kokomo, in the Kokomo area. We were talking earlier this morning about the deadline of January 19th, which is when Chrysler says it may reopen its plants after a 30-day furlough to cut costs. But all of a sudden, after President Bush has spoken, there's a March 31st deadline on the calendar. Chrysler has to demonstrate its viability if it takes any of this federal funds. What do you think the possibility of Chrysler being able to do that is from where you stand?
I think the possibility exists. I have to applaud the president for recognizing that a normal Chapter 11 filing would not be in the best interest of this country. So I think he at least recognizes the potential problems by taking no action. I think that's what, from just the basic information I have, I think it seems like a reasonable proposal to give them, float them the loans, require that they come up with their own plan to make themselves viable. And I think you know, the time frame seems suitable, that they should be able to make this happen.
Well, Mayor, good night. I know there's a lot of details you need to learn before your news conference with the Indiana governor, but just in general, before we go, are you feeling like this is a little reality all of a sudden, that maybe you're going to make it through the first quarter?
I think that's what they're looking for. And I just want to stress that my press conference with the governor is not on the automotive industry. It's over government reform here in Indiana and his plan for the legislature next year.
I can't imagine you'll get a question on the auto industry. No, good night. I can't imagine. That'll never come up. But.
No. It's not on anybody's mind, of course. I think this does give you know, there's nothing wrong with helping somebody, but making them accountable. And I think that's what he's doing with the American automotive industry.
And nothing wrong with rescue in the holiday season. Mayor, good night. We're going to have to go, but thank you so much for joining us a second time this morning.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Greg, good night. Kind of in a sort of Chrysler ground zero there in Kokomo, Indiana, where there's a Chrysler plant, an auto supplier plant. Very happy with the news
this
morning.
But definitely some levity in that voice, a very different voice than what we heard just even 2 hours ago. Also here with us to continue this conversation is Michelle Maynard, a senior business correspondent for The New York Times, who covers the auto industry, and Todd Zwillick, Capital News Connection reporter based in Washington. And Micheline, let's start with the big picture before we talk about some of the details, or at least the few details that President Bush released. Do you think he consulted President-elect Obama? This March 31st date that he has set out for the auto industry to come up with a plan, a restructuring plan, that will be at a time when President Obama is running things.
Absolutely. He absolutely consulted President-elect Obama. And if you noticed yesterday at his press conference, the president-elect had no comment on what was being discussed by the White House. There was a very clear decision made to let the Bush administration handle this. And President Bush said yesterday that he did not want to leave President-elect Obama with a catastrophe on his hands. So, you know, after Congress was unable to approve a bailout package, this got thrown back at the White House. And I think the White House was in consultation with the Obama administration, because there's no point in doing this twice. I mean, this was not going to hold over. The car companies say they didn't have the money to last until January 20th. And it was essentially, the ball was in the Bush administration's court, but I think there was some coaching from the sidelines.
The president, President Bush, made it abundantly clear, Todd and Mickey, as you both know, that the UAW, the automakers, are going to have to come up with a restructuring plan, and now they've got some extra time to do it. What do you think the car makers heard, Mickey?
Well, I think they got time. In fact, the restructuring work really was not being done at all. The car makers thought they'd have a Hail Mary pass of going to Congress that they would get the money with almost no questions asked, because they would say, look, we employ up to 3 million people with the indirect effect of jobs, and we're too important to fail. I don't think they ever expected the reception they got in Washington. I don't think they expected the legislation to fail. I think they've really been put through the ringer. Now they've been slapped around a little bit, and they have 3 months to be serious about a restructuring plan. There's no longer, kicking the can down the alley as they've been doing in the past.
Well, the complexity here is what we were talking about earlier, which is what's made this take so long to get implemented. Todd Zwillick, if there is a serious restructuring that is taking place between now and March 31st, are we talking about negotiations that are going to be happening between now and March 31st? I mean, if the car companies come on March 30th and say, hey, this is it, and it looks bad, it's all over. There's no way the Obama administration is going to allow that to happen.
Right. I mean, I think you're exactly right. They would be foolish to do that, sort of knock on the door on the 30th with, their homework complete and then find out they've done the wrong thing. I'm sure that those discussions will be ongoing. And I imagine also that at the table will be the key principles in Congress as well, along with the Obama administration, because part of the rest of that money is going to have to come with the authorization of Congress and the approval of the Obama administration, not to mention the fact that there is nothing stopping Congress from passing more legislation apropos to the auto industry if it chooses to. They're not saying they will, but they're certainly going to be passing a lot of other legislation about the financial services industry, about Wall Street, other sectors of the economy. Somebody comes up with a bright idea about the auto industry or their suppliers or their unions, there's nothing to stop Congress. So I imagine they'll be at the table.
And here you go, just crossing the wires now, and you're going to be looking into this a bit later, Todd, is Secretary of Treasury Paulson says Congress needs to release the second $350 billion from the Financial Rescue Fund. That would be the second installment there. So you're going to have a busy day, Todd. Todd Zwillick, we thank you so much for joining us here on The Takeaway this morning from Capital News Connection in Washington.
My pleasure.
And Micheline Maynard, as always, a great pleasure to have you.
Oh, thank you so much. It's just nice to be able to do this before Christmas.
Right.
Right, exactly. Mickey Maynard, she is a senior business reporter for the New York Times who covers the auto industry.
That Paulson story means the White House conceded. That's what that means, that they're releasing the $350 billion. They're going to ask for it.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of auto insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adore Udoji.
Good morning. A half an hour, the president spoke, announcing a $17.4 billion loan package for the auto industry. Markets are open, and both the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the S&P 500 are up more than 1%. What's your reaction?
In regards to the bailout, I'm wondering why they're trying to revive a dead horse. People don't have money for these cars, and they don't like these cars. What is the point of giving them all of that money when the industry is dead?
Well, they've got to March 31st to prove you otherwise there. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Give us your thoughts on the auto bailout.
We're going to switch gears here, and I want you to put on your thinking caps for a different reason. I'm going to ask you some questions. Here you go. Do you think poinsettias are poisonous, or that sugar makes children hyperactive, or that you should always wear a hat because most of your body heat is lost from your head? Are these medical myths or realities? Joining us is Dr. Rachel Vreeman, an assistant professor of pediatrics at the Indiana University School of Medicine. She joins us with answers she came up with when she wrote about it, these very questions, in a current British Medical Journal article. Welcome, Dr. Vreeman.
Thank you so much.
So I'm not losing heat if I don't have a hat on? It's not going out through my head?
Well, you are losing some heat through your head, but you're not losing more than you would lose from any other part of your body that was uncovered. Any uncovered part of the body loses heat and will drop your core body temperature, but there's nothing special about the head. If you left your arm uncovered or part of your leg uncovered, you would lose just as much heat through that.
My head is special.
So why have our moms and dads and teachers been telling us for decades that we need to always have our hat on? Where in the world did that come from?
Well, one of the places it came from may have been an old military study where scientists put subjects in Arctic survival suits where everything was covered up except for their heads. And so because they didn't have hats on, they were losing most heat through their heads. And it's the same when we go out into the cold. Often our heads are the only things that we leave uncovered. And so you are losing heat through your head. But again, there's nothing special about the head. If you went out with a hat, but inappropriate clothing otherwise,
like
you
no
lose
socks,
just as much heat. Exactly, no socks or shorts or something like that.
Okay, let's move on to sugar, because we were all shaking our head over this one. We've seen it. I think all of us would swear to it. We've seen a child eat a candy bar and just start running around like superheroes. That's not true. Sugar doesn't cause hyperactivity.
It's not true. And as a pediatrician and someone surrounded by children, I hear this all the time. But it's just not true. In fact, sugar has been studied more than a lot of serious drugs. There are at least 12 great studies, double-blinded, randomized, controlled trials, the kinds of studies that we would love to see for every medication we're using. And in all of these studies, children did not react any differently if they had had a lot of sugar. Even sugar from candy, sugar from chocolate, sugar from natural sources. The studies just all say that sugar doesn't make kids hyperactive.
So it's our lying eyes that tell us that?
That's probably some of it. In fact, a study has been done where they tested that part out. They gave all of the children a sugar-free beverage, but they lied to half of the parents and told those parents that their children had had sugar. And if the parents thought the child had had sugar, they said that the child was behaving worse, even if an objective observer saw no such thing.
So there's a lot of delusional parents out there, in other words. Is that what you came here this morning to tell us?
No. I mean, I think it makes sense, you know, that we believe this because sugar does give our bodies energy. But I think the other thing that's going on is often the occasions where children have sugar or have more of this have other things that might be affecting their behavior. It might be a holiday, staying up late, surrounded by lots of other kids at a party, and even just the special occasion of getting to have sugar.
What inspired you and your co-author to take a look at some of these conventions that you have decided after doing some research are really myths?
Well, as physicians and as scientists, we like to ask why, and we like to know what the truth is behind the things that we're recommending or the treatments we're using and so on. And this is really just us applying our same methods of research and scientific investigation to some commonly held beliefs or myths about our body so that we can remind people in a lighthearted way that we need to think about what the evidence is behind the things that we say, behind the things that we suggest to patients, and probably for some of the more serious things that we recommend as well.
So really, you're just trying to catch scientists in the act. But since we're around the holiday times, quickly tell us about turkey. We've always heard that turkey makes us sleepy or that get those poinsettias away from dogs or children because they're really poisonous. How about those two?
Well, the thing that's to blame in turkey, in most people's minds, is the tryptophan. And turkey does contain tryptophan, but the key is it doesn't contain any more than other types of meat. Ground beef and chicken have exactly the same amounts. And other types of meat, like ham, for example, actually has more tryptophan per gram. But you don't hear ham being blamed for making people sleepy.
However, we have no excuse now after we've stuffed ourselves on the holidays with turkey to say, oh, I got to go take a nap. I need a nap.
You do actually have one excuse in that large meals and alcohol have been shown to make people sleepy quite definitively in scientific studies. So it absolutely could be that. It's just not the turkey that's to blame.
Poinsettias.
Poinsettias get a bad rap too, but again, there's just not the evidence to support that. In fact, the biggest study we could find looked at all of the case reports to the American Association of Poison Control Centers over a period of time. There were almost 23,000 cases in which people had ingested poinsettias, and yet there was no sign of real toxicity. Certainly no one died, and most didn't even have to go to the doctor. Now, we wouldn't recommend eating them. Apparently, they taste horrible, but it's very unlikely that they would cause any significant problem.
Okay, Dr. Rachel Mythbuster Vreeman, that's your new name, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. She's from Indiana University School of Medicine. And now we turn to Femi Oke. He's got headlines for us.
And headlines coming to you at 21 minutes to the top of the hour. President Bush is buying Detroit some time to the tune of $17.4 billion as a bailout for the auto industry. The president announced the terms of the aid earlier this hour, and the money would be drawn from the original $700 billion bailout. Now, investors seem to like the news of the bailout. As the president was speaking, the Dow futures were immediately up. John, how are they doing right now? Markets
both
open.
Both the S&P and the Dow Jones Industrial Average are up about 1% in reaction.
Great. Thanks for that. Got some more economic news from Treasury Secretary Paulson. He wants Congress to release the second $350 billion from the Financial Rescue Fund. That's in direct opposition to the statements he made earlier this week when he said he didn't think the funds would be needed. The Obama cabinet is almost complete. The president-elect is expected to announce California Congresswoman Hilda Solis as Secretary of Labor, and former Dallas Mayor Ron Kirk is to be named the next U.S. trade representative. In Minnesota, Republican Senator Norm Coleman is leading Democrat Al Franken by just 2 votes in the recount for the Senate race. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has ruled that improperly rejected absentee ballots must be included in the state's recount, a move that nearly guarantees that the recount will drag on through into the next year. So that's a look at some of the big stories making news this morning. $17.4 billion bailout for the auto industry is the lead story.
Thanks very much, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. This is The Takeaway. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And hallelujah, we have an auto bailout, which got us thinking. I mean, who would have thought that these brooding, bum-out sounds about a bad relationship with biblical references would actually become a planetary breakup anthem?
Baby, I've been here before. I know this room. I walk this
floor. What, you don't recognize Leonard Cohen singing this? Well, maybe it's more familiar in Arabic. You know, it's unclear what Leonard Cohen imagined about the song Hallelujah when he wrote it back in 1984. But long ago, it became a classic, defying genres and styles.
And even though it all went wrong, I'll stand before the Lord of Song with nothing on my lips but Hallelujah.
Hey, if Bono can play it, anyone can. The song Hallelujah is infectious because it is part spiritual, it's part folk song, it contains wonderfully coded-sounding phrases, the secret chord, and it's easy to play and sing. Hallelujah is currently the number one song and the number two song in the UK. The question is, who hasn't covered it?
Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah.
One of those versions there, Alexandra Burke, is the fastest-selling download ever across Europe, despite only being available since yesterday. Move over, Handel. There's a new Hallelujah in town.
Well, your faith was strong, but you needed proof. So the beat it on the roof. Beauty in the moonlight overthrew you.
She tied you to kitchen chair.
She broke your wig and she cut your hair. And from your mouth, she threw that hallelujah.
You don't have to scream like Bob Dylan to get an emotional reaction from this song. You can go deep and really, really dark.
And I've seen your flag on a marble arch, and love is not.
Baby, I've been here before.
Oh, enough of that.
Heard
there was
Rufus Wainwright reintroduced people to the song in the movie Shrek, but it's not really about green ogres who love the pretty princesses. But maybe it could be. The song, a vessel for whatever the heart holds. Here's Katie Lang.
I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. You don't really care for music, do you?
And of course, the all-time top-selling Hallelujah is from the late Jeff Buckley, who sounds like his voice is coming from beyond the grave.
I heard there was a secret chord that David played and it pleased the Lord. But you don't really care for music, do you?
Buckley's first and only number one hit happened 11 years after his death. It's now sold over 500,000 downloaded copies.
The baffled king composing Hallelujah.
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 Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Friday, December 19th, and Femi Oke has joined us with the day's headlines.
Good morning as well. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The big three automakers will get $17.4 billion in short-term loans. The president announced the terms of the aid earlier this hour. He says the big three carmakers will have until March the 31st to reorganize, or failing that, the loans will allow them time to move toward an orderly bankruptcy. The president said the money would be drawn from the original $700 billion bailout. Later today, the president will host Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas to discuss stalled peace talks with Israel. It's probably their last meeting before the president leaves office next month. And the peace process doesn't look too rosy at the moment. The militant group Hamas says that it will let its six-month ceasefire with Israel expire, and there have already been reports of rocket fire across the border. And Deep Throat has died. Mark Felt was number two at the FBI when he secretly gave journalists Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein tips that helped lead to Watergate. And Woodward says that there are a couple of reasons why no one found out about Mark Felt's identity for more than 30 years.
He wouldn't talk, and my colleague Carl Bernstein and I and others at the Washington Post kept our word. He was insistent that we not disclose, and I think we wanted to protect that principle.
And that was Bob Woodward, the journalist there, talking about Mark Felt, who just died, and he'd been suffering from heart failure for several months. Now, finally, if you haven't sent your Christmas mail yet, you have one more day to do it first class. The U.S. Postal Service says that your last chance is tomorrow to make sure that your post gets there by December the 24th. And if you're still procrastinating, if you use Express Mail, it will get there by December the 23rd. That's your deadline. And that's a look at some of the news making the headlines this morning.
Thanks very much, Femi. In just weeks, you'll not only begin to know the name Robert Gibbs, but he's going to become one of the most watched people in Washington, D.C. when he becomes the White House press secretary. He's a 37-year-old veteran of politics from Alabama, and many say few people are closer to President-elect Barack Obama than he is. So what can we expect? New York Times Magazine writer Mark Leibovich has a few thoughts. He has a profile of Gibbs in this weekend's New York Times Magazine. Welcome back and good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
When you read about Gibbs, one of the things that you're struck by most is just how close he is to Barack Obama.
No, they have spent many, many, many hours together on many, many planes and many hotels over the last 4.5 years since Gibbs went to work for him originally, and particularly over the last 2 years since Obama's presidential campaign started. That is somewhat unusual for a White House spokesman. I mean, typically there are a few layers of remove between the president and the the guy who goes on the podium every day and briefs the press. So this should, you know, create an interesting dynamic in that on one hand, Robert will be, you know, imbued with a lot of information. He knows the rhythms of this president really, really well. But on the other hand, information, you know, can help you, you know, speak with a kind of authority, but it can also be somewhat perilous in that you can, you have to be even extra careful not disclosing information that's sensitive and that shouldn't get out.
But he's certainly been very good at doing that through the primary process. I mean, this is a group of people who are well known for being able to keep information and not have it leak out.
Very much so. I mean, this is a very, very tight-knit, loyal, you know, group at the top of the Obama campaign. Now, you know, when you get into a White House, the circle certainly expands, and there are new people involved. There are cabinet officials and their staffs involved. There's Congress involved. So it can be much harder to keep, you know, tight a lid on information. And as we've seen in the transition, I mean, it's been pretty leaky. I mean, there have been
right.
a number of instances of names of cabinet officials or cabinet appointments coming out a few days before they were intended to. So, I mean, it should be an interesting, you know, thing to evolve.
And you certainly write about how Barack Obama was apparently livid by the leaks related to Hillary Clinton. And her nominating her to be Secretary of State. But let's talk about Gibbs. He's from Alabama. He's 37 years old. He's been in politics a long time. How do you describe his demeanor, his outlook?
Robert is, on one hand, I mean, sort of a backslapper. Joke-telling, you know, very affable guy in many ways, but he also has some real pit bull tendencies in defense of his boss. You know, Robert is combative. He can be combative. I mean, there are some pretty well-publicized shouting matches he actually had on the air during the campaign. Once, pretty famously with Sean Hannity of Fox News. So he is, I mean, exceedingly loyal. I mean, he is not he's not someone who is probably going to make a lot of news from the podium. I mean, there aren't really any examples that many can think of or I can think of him sort of screwing up and you know, misspeaking. I mean, I'm sure there will be some. But Robert is he's a pro. He is, I think, somewhat well-liked within the press. But I also think I don't think you're going to come across many people who say that, you know, he has really spilled the beans for them on anything either.
Well, Mark, let's look at this from the perspective of what it says about Obama's vision of how the White House is going to function. I mean,
right.
on one hand, he definitely wants few, if any, leaks, which maybe
right.
argues for a Bush-style inner circle, which was
right.
pretty darn good in the first term.
Right.
But on the other hand, there's a kind of a high intellectual sort of level that Obama projects, and that argues mm-hmm. for a more of a Pierre Salinger kind of Kennedy style. Which do you think?
Yeah, it's a tough balance. I mean, their watchwords are transparency and openness. I mean, they are the things that they say over and over and over again when they discuss their communication strategy. But, you know, at the same time—
And I don't think many people actually believe that.
Well, I mean, whether they do or not, I mean, they also explicitly told me for the story that they followed the quote-unquote Bush model of communications discipline on the campaign, which, you know, many would say is at odds with the notion of transparency
exactly.
and openness. So it's a very, I mean, I think, you know, on one hand, if you're going to, you know, use the internet and put the weekly radio address on YouTube, as, mm-hmm. as the Obama people are doing, I mean, you know, it's a bell and whistle in some ways. I mean, it's saying, okay, we're using high tech to make this all more accessible, but you know, you also have to ask, I mean, how much information is really being imparted, you know, useful information is being imparted that wouldn't be otherwise.
And, yeah, you're bringing up a point that came to my mind, which is this going to be a departure about the way the press communicates with the White House when you're talking about the Internet, the reliance on non-traditional means of communicating that the Barack Obama campaign adopted? Is there going to be less reverence for the traditional Washington press corps that we've seen over the decades?
I mean, if the campaign is any indication, yes. I mean, they spoke, again, quite openly to me about their, you know, real almost disdain for, you know, insider publications, they would say. I mean, there's this, you know, the Politico, which is a political magazine, you know, largely online, is something they aggressively, you know, tried to ignore. And they, you know, they sort of boasted about not doing any editorial board meetings with the Washington Post, which would be unheard of, you know, for a previous candidate. But, you know, again, you know, and Gibbs said, you know, not a lot of people in Waterloo, Iowa are reading the Washington Post.
Ouch.
He said pretty proudly. But at the same time, you know, in Washington, there are a lot of people reading the Washington Post, and these are the constituents. I mean, you know, the constituencies changes now, and you know, every member of Congress is going to pick up the Washington Post in the morning, it'll be interesting to see, you know, how they sort of shift from a level of almost disdain for Washington and the media rules of the city to actually trying to cater to it to some degree.
That disdain that you talk about, there's almost a gleeful tone in some of the quotes that you provide in your article.
Right.
Best guess, Mark, does Gibbs understand what he's getting into, or is he, like, loving this and going to jump in with, you know, all limbs?
I think both. I mean, it sounds like a cop-out answer, but I think he is having fun in some ways. I mean, I think he does recognize the historical moment of this, and I think he likes being on TV, I mean, which is an important, you know, thing for someone in that job.
There's a lot of hams in Washington, D.C., Mark.
I guess so.
Of course not you included.
Never,
yeah. Mark Leibovich, from the New York Times, he's got an article in this weekend's magazine, a profile of Robert Gibbs, the Barack Obama pick for White House press secretary.
Whose face will be on everybody's cranium very, very shortly. Well, the president spoke within the hour. That would be President Bush, and he announced a $17.4 billion in loans in exchange for concessions from the auto industry. What are your thoughts?
The auto industry is not dead. The Japanese know how to build cars in this country and sell them, and people buy them. The problem with the American companies, GMs, is the unions and their bloated wages, including the so-called jobs bank, where they're paid to do nothing for days and weeks at a time.
We've got a debate going at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Here's your takeaway.
He said Chapter 11 several times during his statement, and that is no accident. Essentially, they've got a little bit over 3 months to get their act together, or they end up in bankruptcy.
That's Micheline Maynard, senior business correspondent for the New York Times. They've got till March 31st. That's the deadline to demonstrate viability that President Bush, within the hour, has declared the auto industry has to do to get these $17.4 billion in loans. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.